I'm Stefan Ango, co-founder of Lumi, and this is Well Made, a show about the intersection of business and design. Today we're joined by Richie Siegel. He's the creator and writer behind the site Loose Threads. It's one of my favorite up-and-coming blogs that goes really deep into analyzing exactly what's happening in the world of fashion, technology, and commerce. For our first episode of 2017, I thought we'd look back at some of the big trends that Richie wrote about over the past year and where we think things might go next. Okay, so slightly different format this week. We are talking to Richie Siegel, who is the creator of Loose Threads, writer. And the way I want to go about it this week is to talk a little bit about 2016. We just wrapped up a pretty interesting year, I think, in terms of, well, we'll set aside everything that you might be thinking when I say 2016. But talk a little bit about the fashion, technology, direct-to-consumer industry that you've been talking about on your website, loosethreads.xyz, which is my favorite new top-level domain, I think.
Yeah, I was just looking for a top-level one, and I thought it was kind of interesting, and I could get the Twitter handle as well, so that's how that happened. But yeah, I mean, I think, so I wrote this post, which is kind of the impetus for this discussion, which basically looked at six different trends that would summarize the past year and happening. And I think at a high level, and I'm sure we'll get into kind of some of those in a bit, I think this was a year where you basically had a lot of tailwinds of the early direct-to-consumer craze started with stuff like Everlane and Bonobos and some of those brands. A lot of, I think, either that conventional wisdom or that full speed ahead on this D2C is the full answer thing, kind of gravity got to that a bit and started to get a little more kind of nuanced. And I think when you look at this industry, and I'll define this as basically, you know, the intersection of fashion, technology, and commerce, that little triangle or big triangle maybe, there have been a lot of things recently where I think the industry and the press has been really searching for this golden formula. And I think this was kind of the year that I, and I think some others, hopefully started to realize that there is actually no golden formula, that this industry is incredibly complex. It's changing at an incredibly fast pace. But I think we started to see little pockets of the industry work in different ways, and that there is no kind of right pocket to pull from if you are a new brand starting today, be that a wholesale brand or a D2C brand or whatever that is. So that's kind of, that's the high level, I guess, I would start with.
Yeah, and when I think about that trend, I do think the current generation, when would you pinpoint the kind of start of that?
Okay, so I kind of want to look, but I feel like, I think Everlane was 2008, 9, or 10?
5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
Is when it really started to kick off, and right. Warby Parker and those people started to show up as well.
Right. Let's consider them kind of V1 of what, you know, Andy Dunn would call a digitally native vertical brand, or DNVB. We could maybe cap at 2012, 2013. And then I think in the last 3 to 4 years, you see kind of version two, which are brands that are, I would consider something like Outdoor Voices or some of these other brands that are a lot newer and glossier and kind of taking some of those lessons. They're smaller right now, but they're also seeing pretty interesting kind of growth rates as well. And so I would consider those maybe V2.
So one of the things that really punctuated the year was Dollar Shave Club, I think, being acquired because,
right,
you know, it was a big flashy, you know, $1 billion acquisition from Unilever. Those are part of the V1 in your definition, right?
Yeah.
They're kind of right at the edge.
But yeah, I would consider, you know, Dollar Shave, Warby Parker, Bonobo, some of, you know, Everlane that are much bigger now because they've obviously had the time and the runway to get there, kind of those V1.
Like, what do you see are the differences between those two generations? And are we now just about to hit a third generation?
Yeah, so let me answer the first question first, because I probably would need to think about the second one. I think if you look at that first generation, you see what I would consider kind of putting like the stakes in a bunch of kind of big industries. And so with Warby Parker, you had, okay, let's finally take on L'Exotica. You know, I'm sure many of us have seen that 60-minute segment of just how infuriating it is that a single company controls the licenses and basically has a monopoly on eyeglassware, both, you know, the glasses themselves and a retail. And so Warby Parker's like, let's do this differently and have, you know, a ethical backbone, so to speak, that we're going to help people who can't see and get them, you know, the money that gets them the glasses to do that. With Dollar Shave, I think, yeah, maybe we call these like the attackers in a way that they went after these really, really big behemoths in a way that were just moving too slowly and weren't going to ever adapt. So you have Warby Parker with eyeglasses, you have Dollar Shave going after Unilever and some of in other kind of P&G brands. You have Bonobos going after, let's say, Gap and J. Crew on kind of just the pant and the very kind of basic male wardrobe. And then if I move over to V2, I think we see, you know, it's interesting to think about, are V2 opportunities smaller? And I think that's actually a really interesting question, but they're also much more specific. So you have an Outdoor Voices that is going after basically athleisure or athletic apparel with a kind of fashion mindset or aesthetic. You have companies like Combat Gentlemen that are trying to build basically a 21st century men's warehouse. You have a lot more kind of like stratification in a way around these
slightly smaller industries.
I would almost call them less big because I have no clue how big or small they are, but I don't know if they're the like prize winners in that a Warby or a Dollar Shave might be. But these smaller opportunities are actually really interesting because they're starting to get, you know, a Warby Parker, for example, is really big and they're going to play that whole scale game. But you have, let's say, a Garrett Light on the other hand, which is trying to build a really amazing kind of wholesale and direct-to-consumer eyeglass brand kind of predicated on quality, not necessarily price. And so the nuances, I think, are becoming a lot more interesting in these version two companies.
Well, and there are areas where traditionally it has been very competitive. Like fashion has always been extremely competitive. Something like razor blades, you know, it's interesting because I would say there's probably three or four startups that are kind of exist in that same area. You know, when you think about, obviously, Dollar Shave Club, Harry's, there's three or four kind of at that level. But when you think about shavers in general, it's like Gillette and
right.
Whoever it is. Like, so those are areas where I can definitely see there being even more people. I mean, will there be someone who tries to take on Dollar Shave Club soon?
Mm-hmm.
Is an interesting question. But then when I think about where does Dollar Shave Club sit if it existed in the old economy, it's like at the drugstore in that one aisle that sells that one product. There's 10 other aisles full of other types of right. products, whether it's toothpaste or deodorant or whatever, that seem like prime opportunities among these like smaller type of ideas that seem very plausible for people to start attacking. And I'm already starting to see some. I saw a few vitamin related startups, and then one that's doing contact lenses. So there's definitely quite a big fragmentation of opportunities in terms of direct-to-consumer brands taking that idea on.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this actually, you know, leads, and I didn't write about this in that post, but I think this is maybe what I would put as point seven, which is I think this was also the year that a lot of these subscription businesses came crashing back down to earth. And I think we basically, as an industry, probably vastly over-indexed on what should actually be a good subscription business and what maybe even if there's some things that could be, they were maybe run poorly. And I feel like the last 2 to 3 years were the year of just like, hey, that could be a subscription, that could be a subscription. And it was started with almost the business model in mind and not actually the problem. And so something like Dollar Shave makes perfect sense because replenishment with razors is annoying. And if you find the thing you like, you want to just keep using that thing. But I think we see stuff, you know, like Birchbox or some of these other companies that are using a subscription element, and whether they are, they're more of a retail play is a bit into semantics. But I mean, something like we were talking about Cratejoy before, which is really interesting, which is, you know, a platform for subscription companies to exist is new in it of itself and kind of emblematic of the times. And I think obviously the subscription business model is great because, you know, who doesn't like annuities? It's obviously a dream. But I think you'll see investors and other people start to have a little more scrutiny on that. I would consider the business model itself agnostic, but it's what do you put in that business model is quite an interesting question these days.
But certainly it seemed like the Dollar Shave Club was a validation that whether it's a subscription or not, it's possible to build that kind of business and that it can be valuable. And it weirdly came as a weird surprise almost because I think it was a bit of a sleeper. I don't think people were expecting that to come in at that time. And when I say people, I mean the sort of investment community and the people who write about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll just say this. I mean, in a funny way, I would consider really the true genius of Dollar Shave Club was almost like Trumpian in its way of using free marketing to basically...
I don't know if we should go there.
What I'll just say is, you know, like in the same way that Trump objectively used the news media to get hundreds of million dollars of free airtime, I think you saw Dollar Shave with that video just get so much free press and I think it was, you know, tens of millions of views in a really interesting way. And I think, again, in a time where we have so much noise from like a customer acquisition perspective of just, you know, people are spending so much money on Facebook ads and AdWords and all these other platforms, you're starting to see some of these really interesting examples that are actually cutting through in kind of reallocating that spend maybe towards production or something like that and not necessarily towards just the media buy itself. And so that to me is also really interesting to see because I don't know the entire economics behind this, but I would assume as more of these brands come online, the cost to advertise are only going to rise because there's so much more competition to kind of vie for that same consumer. And I'm really curious to see where that kind of economic situation goes and what does it start to cost to cut through the noise as more of these D2C or kind of marketing driven companies exist.
Yeah, that was one of the points in your article that generally that's a way that you can burn out as well. Spending a lot on advertising and those costs continuing to increase is not going to help anything.
Right. So I think there are generally, there are a few ways to look at this. I think there's some businesses that, you know, at a certain point, if you can figure out the economics, you can just pump unlimited money into them and they will prosper. And so you look at a company like Casper, I think there was a lot of conventional wisdom that this Casper, the mattress company, that, you know, it's interesting because I think a lot of people are in this kind of subscription ethos, which is, well, you only buy a mattress, you know, every 5 years or every 8 years. So, you know, it's a one-time purchase and we're looking at all these other subscription companies, but there's a way to create the unit economics of a product like that where it really doesn't matter if someone buys it every 5 years, where you can just make a ton of money selling a mattress. And so I'm in New York and they have just been blanketing the subways nonstop. I don't know if they have an equivalent here in LA with billboards or something, but I mean, we would get on the train some days and there's just a Casper train. And on the one hand, it's crazy because you see stuff like that. They, you know, Venmo did that with, they just put that guy Lucas, I think, all over the subways and stuff like that. But there's a way where if the unit economics makes sense, this can be very, very viable. On the other hand, you have stuff where, you know, I wrote one of the bigger pieces I wrote this year is about Nasty Gal, where they had, you know, from what it looks like, is they would spend a ton of money in acquisition, but, you know, it was considered effectively a leaky bucket, which means they were basically pumping into acquisition and then those people were never coming back again. And so if the model doesn't work, you're obviously in trouble, but I think it's the mechanism itself is somewhat agnostic, but we're seeing the importance of looking at things like unit economics and lifetime value and return rate, given, you know, these companies are throwing so much money. This is, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in aggregate on advertising. So I think the bar is definitely going up into what does it mean to be a venture-backed company that's going to advertise and how good you need to be at that.
Yeah. And this is something that you were talking about in your post as well, but what are the commonalities between the ones that kind of flamed out and the ones that seem to continue to thrive?
Yeah. I mean, I think the unit economics is probably the oversimplified but kind of true answer, which is, yeah, I think economics are really interesting because there's a guy on Twitter named Trent Griffin who I think works at Microsoft and just goes on these obsessive rants about economics and makes some jokes that they're like so random, but they're kind of funny because he just does these tweet storms on it. And if you follow him, he kind of pounds into your head that like there's a difference between unit economics and if a business is profitable. And kind of one of the biggest examples of this has been a lot of the reporting about Uber recently, which there have been all these headlines, you know, Uber loses $800 million this quarter, something like that. And I think the reality in a lot of this stuff is it's really nuanced and it frankly is really boring, you know, to actually go into the details of whether a company is, you know, is unit profitable or quarterly profitable or if it's a net loss or has negative, you know, gross margin or stuff like that. And it takes like a lot of time, energy, and also just knowledge to actually get to the bottom of some of these things. And so on the one hand, it's like kind of cool the press is just trying to write about this stuff. But on the other, there's just like so much missing. And so, you know, on that Uber thing, for example, they basically conflated, you know, being a not profitable company with having, you know, negative unit economics. And so I think the nuance on this is really important. In terms of the commonalities, I think the unit economics are really important. And I also think it comes down to kind of like how much you're going to pump into the spend right away. I think a lot of these companies have, you have a finite amount of runway with whatever money it is that you raised. And ideally you would like test it. And once you kind of get to the point where you're like, okay, this is really good, you would just kind of, you know, light the fire and turn it up. And if I go back to Nasty Gal, for example, which is kind of just the one that I've analyzed the most out of all of these that have flamed out, they kind of just like cranked the handle and then just expected it to work. And I don't really know if there was a time of kind of fine-tuning all of the things that are really complex about that. And so on the one hand, it makes sense, right? You have this money in the bank. It's making it, you know, no money sitting there. You want to kind of push it out and get all the growth. But I think the customer acquisition piece is becoming really challenging. And there are a finite amount of people, I think, right now that are really good at it. I mean, it's turning into like pure math more so than it is kind of this cloud of marketing that maybe old marketing used to be, and it really is becoming an economics game.
Yeah. When we think about some of those other categories where, you know, who knows what the top five next categories that right now you're buying in a store, or you're buying on Amazon that you might someday buy from a specific company that maybe doesn't exist yet. Certainly the piece about the cost of advertising is really interesting because you get to a point where perhaps in a 2010 world, it was possible to build a brand off of Facebook ads because the costs were lower. But now you get to a point where as the cost of advertising rise, certain types of businesses maybe become impossible because the incumbents have such an advantage. Like if you're, let's just say toothpaste or something like that, Colgate and Crest or whoever have so much brand power because they've been around for so long and you've seen their names for so long that even if you're some startup and you're pumping a lot of money into Facebook ads, like
right.
it might just not be possible.
Right. And that's an interesting question too, because again, this is entirely speculation, but I'm curious if Dollar Shave Club would have been the success that it was without the video, because would they have been able to basically outbid all of the kind of major incumbents on that? And I think what's interesting now is that problem in a way forced them to think differently about how they would approach marketing. And I hope to see more of that in the future because it's really interesting and it's much more interesting to talk to than just like kind of CPG ad spend stuff.
Yeah. But CPG is probably the place where we're going to see the most new stuff, I would suspect. I think that that's a huge area. There's so many brands that have existed for so long. It just seems ripe for new people to come in trying different things.
Yeah. I mean, one of the most interesting ones that I really like is called Function of Beauty, which is this company out of, I think they're MIT grads out of Boston, and their whole thing basically is about like shampoo and conditioner. And so basically you go in a similar way and you basically go like, what are your hair goals and what do you want out of this? And you choose the color. And they basically have, I think, 218 million different combinations of formula, color, bottle size that they can send to you as like kind of your entirely custom shampoo and conditioner. And that to me is a really interesting example because it just gets rid of the need to go look on a shelf for something that is, you know, you would be wrapping your own preference to the existing options as opposed to just creating the option for yourself. And I'm sure it's delivered at a cost that, you know, to do that actually is, you know, much, much lower than what would happen. But at the end of the day, it was like a nice experience to do it. And I think, you know, as you alluded to before, there's a lot of the CPG stuff, which is just kind of a product that is, you know, above average functional, collecting dust on a shelf. And the question of personalization on CPG is actually quite interesting, which I haven't really thought about. But I'm really curious to see what happens with that because, you know, it's interesting to think, I'm just like coming up with company ideas right now. Like what would like that version of a deodorant company be or a toothpaste company if you want, you know, whitening or cavity prevention or more fluoride or something like that?
Well, I think we've gotten to the point where you walk into, you know, your local drugstore and you get to that toothpaste aisle and there's literally 200 different types of toothpaste that you can choose from. And I think those are the moments in time where someone who says, this is the one toothpaste that you need, it's simple, you know, it's good in XYZ way, that is really refreshing for people. And I think that's what a lot of successful direct-to-consumer brands have done. So anywhere where there's that kind of like complexity, there's room for someone to come in and provide a simple answer.
Right. I think the flip side to that, though, and I think we've seen this a fair bit in the industry, is there's the possibility for like a technocrat in a way to oversimplify things. And so
yeah.
The example I always come back to on this is Everlane's men collection. Personally, I do not know a single person that wants to wear their like immensely basic, pared down, you know, two color stuff because it almost like kind of just like sucks the soul out of what clothing is or should be. And I get it on one hand because it is very much the technologist approach to clothing. But the flip side is I think you can go too far almost. And so to walk into a store to get on a website where there is, you know, this is your toothpaste and this is your, right? Like there's an interesting way to both simplify but also allow for that personal element. Mm-hmm. And maybe that is something that we're going to see more of in the future, maybe specifically in CPG, where it's easier but it's also yours in a way where, you know, Colgate is not mine. It's just the thing I picked off the shelf.
Yeah, that's a good point. What else 2016 did we learn as an industry?
So one of the other things on there, I think, is about kind of the wholesale and the retail thing. And I'll combine kind of two from what I wrote. So I think the first was, you know, speaking of Everlane, I think there was a quote from Michael Pressman. And again, one of my favorite quotes is having strong opinions loosely held. So I won't dwell on this, but, you know, he said early on that, you know, we will never open a retail store. And I think what we started to see this year is that retail is incredibly important for brands and especially for digitally native vertical brands. I think if you see companies like Outdoor Voices or Everlane has been doing pop-ups all year, Combat and Gentleman has been doing stores and pop-ups, Garrett Light has been doing stores. I think this is not a trend, but this is just the reality. You know, Bonobos has been doing guide shops. Warby Parker has been doing their own stores. I guess you almost saw this become conventional wisdom in the last year or two. And basically, defining a business by channel is becoming less interesting than defining the experience by the channel. And so what I mean by that is, I think people were really interested in taking positions as just we are online only, we are retail, we are this, as opposed to just saying what experience do you want to build and then what channel will serve that experience best. And maybe a lot of this is solution before problem stuff, but I think what we started to see is, okay, if you actually tackle the problem, maybe the solution is retail, which is great. The flip side is, and this kind of circles back to what we were talking about before with the marketing part, was generally you have two types of business. You have a wholesale business that sells to a third party, which then sells to the end consumer. Then you have a direct-to-consumer business that obviously sells directly to the consumer. And I think one of the pieces, again, getting back to this stuff is really complex and frankly boring to most people, is that each of those businesses take a different type of person and more specifically a different type of team. And so, you know, a wholesale business is really a great team, you know, specifically in the fashion space. Is really great for a team that is design driven, is, you know, supply chain driven, is really good at kind of the stuff that creates the final product. The flip side is you have these D2C brands that are really, you know, in some ways I would consider Dollar Shave Club this, they're really a marketing company that happens to sell a product, right? So their bread and butter is customer acquisition and marketing and merchandising and e-commerce and all these other things. And there are some brands that can mix those two and do them well, but they're generally two different types of skill sets. And so I think maybe from the outside and hopefully from the inside, existing companies as well as people that are also looking to start new companies are starting to understand some of the nuances and maybe different needs and or responsibilities that each of those different companies can have. Because generally, if you mismatch those, it's not a good situation.
Yeah, I think what you said at the very beginning is something that, you know, bears repeating, because it's like the narrative was created around these companies saying, part of the reason we're able to sell this product to you at a lower price is because we're direct to consumer. And, you know, a big part of Everlane is messaging was like, look at all these things that we're removing from the cost of the final product that gets to you. But as we see these companies open up stores, I think you're right. It's like, what was the narrative? What was the thing that was powerful in the beginning that actually maybe wasn't the real thing that was true about that company? What was true about that company is that they're still direct to consumer,
100%.
Except that the channels in which they sell are not just online, but in these other places as well.
Right. And I mean, if you take the term direct to consumer kind of literally, I would consider Gap a direct to consumer brand. I would consider Zara a direct to consumer brand. They're not digitally native, which is kind of that other piece. But in a way, yeah, I mean, this maybe those are retail-driven, direct-to-consumer brands, but that idea itself has been around for a while. I think it can get bastardized pretty quickly, which, again, that just happens. But I think the interesting stuff is really the complexity of what happens when you kind of approach channel as a tool almost and not the story in a way. And you basically, you know, see these brands, and I wrote about this a bit as well, as having basically superior cost structures when starting online to then go into retail. And so I think one of the best examples here is what Amazon has been doing with its bookstores. So you have traditionally, you know, Barnes & Noble and, you know, what used to be Borders, which have stores that are 5 times bigger than Amazon's own bookstores that are, I think, in Seattle and a few other places today. And it's a really interesting thing to look at, because Amazon has been basically able to utilize all their technological and digital advantages to, you know, utilize 1/5 of the store size to deliver arguably a better experience than an actual bookstore. And so I think, you know, you could argue Bonobos and the guide shops are an example of this, which I believe have really high sales per square foot. I think Warby Parker is another example of this. And, you know, the flip side of this is you have a lot of these kind of big stores and department stores and malls that are, you know, really in trouble, because, you know, I talk a bit about, or wrote a bit about, building stores for the experience you want, not building experiences for the stores you have. This is a big problem that a lot of these bigger, older legacy stores are running into, is that they have these legacy retail fleets, you know, 100,000 square foot stores and all this. And the reality is no one needs any of that stuff. And so I think as you see these D2C brands go into retail, you're going to see much, much smaller stores than you would have in the past, which I think is interesting, but also really problematic from a, you know, hiring perspective. There are just less people to employ. there's less real estate. And interestingly, all the real estate is actually shifting to fulfillment centers. And so I've always wanted to, and I hope people are doing this, that are basically trying to arbitrage where Amazon will put its next fulfillment center and just like buy a really nice plot of land, make it very level for the robots, and then just sell it to Amazon or release it to them. Because there seems to be a very interesting shift in commercial real estate going from malls and all of that into fulfillment, which I think is quite interesting.
There's a post that I wrote as well back in September that was, it's called Vertical Commerce and How the Next Generation of Retail Will Be Built. And there's a whole section about, I hate this word, but it's clicks to bricks. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just hilariously catchy. But there's so many different ways that people are doing it. And I just like, I just wrote one sentence about all the buzzwords, but it's like the pop-up, pop-in, showroom, kiosk, store within a store, the flagship stores as well. And then there's also actually interesting new business models. Like there's this store called Beta. I don't know if you've come across mm-hmm. this. It's a store that is basically, I mean, really they're a consignment store for electronics, but that's an unusual business model for electronics. Consignment is popular in fashion, but all those different things are, store within a store. Is Warby Parker did a lot of that initially, which is mostly with boutiques having
right.
someone who's trained, who's actually a Warby Parker employee, or someone within the company that has the retail store who's trained on that product. Kiosks, like we saw Snapchat, probably right. is one of the most interesting physical retail experiences that happened, where they're just like dropping these like kiosks in random places around the country. The pop-in is a term that has come up, which is basically you're describing the problem that malls have. You're describing the problem that, you know, someone like a JCPenney or Macy's or any of the department stores have all this real estate. They're trying to find ways to create pop-up space within their space mm-hmm. for brands to use. And so the thing that is such a luxury for all of these direct-to-consumer brands is that they can use any of these strategies.
Right.
All
they have
of
a choice.
Them are available to them. They don't have that inventory of space that they need to deal with.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, I mean, to most people this stuff's boring, but, you know, the idea of kind of what does your cost structure allow or kind of force you to do, I think was also a really interesting kind of story this year, which, you know, maybe lies underneath a lot of the other things we've talked about, which is, it's very easy to open a pop-up shop or to open a few thousand square foot store. It's so much harder to convert a 50,000 square foot store into something that is inviting and that people actually want to go to. One of the other parts too, which I think is, you know, talk to some other people about this and it's not entirely original, is that e-commerce is actually much harder and more expensive than retail itself because there are a lot of efficiencies you can get by shipping a lot of stuff to a single place and unloading it and all that stuff. And so you see these struggles in retailers, you see them with brands, you also see them with the mere logistics networks with UPS and FedEx and USPS that are, you know, have, let's say, a hard learning curve to adapt a lot of their infrastructure towards single packages. And so, you know, it's really interesting to look at what Amazon is doing, where basically, you know, they, from a cost structure perspective, have been able to build out a logistics network that is perfectly prime for basically single boxes or for their own stuff. And you realize how, I mean, I think in the UK, Amazon surpassed the Royal Mail's capacity just because they don't know how to handle what they're doing and they're not kind of perfectly primed for it. And so I would add cost structure and kind of deep thoughts about it to, you know, next to, let's say, customer acquisition is one of those things that I think is increasingly so fundamental. And maybe it has always been, but there's more of a learning curve almost recently about how important it is both as an advantage and a disadvantage.
Do you see that as, like, looking forward a little bit on 2017, is that another source of problems for companies that exist today?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at, and I wouldn't totally define this by age of companies as well. Like, you know, to me, Zara is one of the most nimble, fascinating companies in this, which has been around for, I think, 20, 30 years. But I was reading about Gap recently, and they, I think, had an initiative to cut their supply chain lead times down from, I think, 9 months to 6 months. And I'm sure there's a lot of, like, congratulations for that, but you're still at 6 months. Mm-hmm. And Zara is at 20 days, basically. And so it's probably physically impossible for Gap to get anywhere near that. Obviously, again, just because of cost structure and supply chain logistics and how it kind of also culturally has existed for so long. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if this is like an original thought at all, but I think people's existing cost structures will continue to bite them in the ass, maybe faster. And it's getting faster because stuff is advancing so quickly. I mean, to be kind of these middle of the road, kind of middle of the market, generic, undifferentiated brands, I think is a really, really hard place to be in. And whether it's companies, you know, like Gap or Express or some, a lot of these kind of generic mall brands, I'm very curious how they can respond, because it seems that they're quite stuck in a way, for lack of a better word. Jake, I would add J. Crew to that as well, which is not evolved in, you know, 8 years or anything. So I think maybe to be some of these mall first original retail brands are going to continue to struggle.
Yeah. I mean, the thing, and that's always the supply and demand equation. Maybe the cost of being in a mall is going to go down. And so maybe it makes it now affordable for a startup to have its own store in a mall.
Yeah. I mean, the mall thing's interesting. So I think there's probably an over index thing that malls are dying. I think if you actually look at it, and Mark Bain, who writes for Quartz, has done a lot of nice stuff on this. The high-end malls are doing fantastic, and Racked has also reported on this. They're doing really, really well. The bad malls in the middle of the market malls are not doing well. The flip side is, you know, you have people like Andy Dunn, who I think about a year ago basically was like, I'm going to prove that malls are not dying, and I'm going to put my Bonobo stores in malls. And I believe that experiment has gone well, and that they continue to open them, and that they actually are doing well. And so, yes, probably Bonobos is a higher-end brand, and that kind of proves the point that the higher end is working. But I think, yeah, the idea of the mall itself is changing. I was out near my parents' house, and I went to the mall for the first time in, you know, 4 or 5 years, and the biggest line was at Annie's Pretzels. And I've never seen that before, and it was actually next to Starbucks. But, like, it felt down. It was quiet. It was a Saturday or Sunday. And so I think, you know, again, you get back to what sort of experience can you differentiate with in person that you cannot get online? And I think a lot of, again, kind of legacy physical entities are have to ask themselves that question a lot, because if it's harder for me to drive there, there's more friction, and I could just get it online, I don't really know why I would go. The flip side of this is, and I think this ties back to Amazon, is that you have some of these bigger companies like Amazon or whatever kind of devouring like the middle and the commodity level stuff. And so, you know, stuff like white t-shirts and socks and kind of all these things that, you know, it's much easier to get on Amazon. The flip side is you have this entire kind of high end that you would call kind of design driven, which they're never going to touch. We talked about this before, but you have all these opportunities now to go, okay, if Amazon's going to take away the boring stuff, how can I differentiate with design, with experience, with all these other things? And that to me is really interesting to think about. I mean, to me, it's really boring to be a white t-shirt company. And so I'm kind of happy that someone else is going to just kind of taken that away. But it now becomes, what can I do that is so different and differentiated and defendable that I'm not worried about Amazon kind of knocking it off because it's so far away from the commodity kind of middle scale market that they are so good at owning?
Now, that's a good question. I think that, you know, we mentioned a lot of those brands, but what makes it defendable? I mean, Amazon will never, like, they're so relentless. How do they deal with that problem?
Yeah, I think if you can still go to relentless.com and it will redirect to Amazon.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure. And so I wrote a big piece this year about the second biggest piece in Business of Fashion about Amazon's kind of fashion ambitions.
Yeah.
And collected just a bunch of stuff as well as kind of original analysis about this, because I wanted to put it all in one place because it's been kind of pretty fragmented. And my conclusion at the end was basically, if you can give up these kind of huge scale commodity things, there's really this opportunity for design driven people to create products that are both differentiated and defendable that Amazon won't really be interested in them. On the one hand, you could say that this is going to lead to smaller overall brands, and maybe there are not the opportunities to build multi-hundred million or multi-billion dollar brands on Amazon itself, because they will just take over, right? Because at a certain point, if you get that big, you have to be somewhat generic. The flip side is, and I think this has been lost recently with all this kind of crazy venture capital, is there's kind of been this death of the small business itself, and that idea that a entrepreneur or a designer or someone can do something or start something that, you know, can make, you know, 500,000 or a million or two or four or $10 million. And I think we're going to see, and obviously the internet has allowed this, reemergence of like really good small businesses. And that to me is, I think, the way to basically both take advantage of Amazon, but stay out of their path the same way, which is like to build something nice that like can provide you and a small team of people a really nice living.
What do you have examples of ones that are out there currently?
Oh, that's a good question. I probably should. Yeah. I don't know any off the top of my head.
I mean, the guys who always come to mind are people like my friends who run Studio Neat. Like, they're two people who make a whole bunch of Apple accessories, you know, stylus and a watch dock for the Apple Watch. you know, they're great. I mean, and there's a whole sort of group of people who come from that generation of like Kickstarter driven companies that are able to stay really lean and they make a living.
Yeah.
It's two or three or a handful of people who are making a living selling a couple products.
Totally. And I think you can get to, you know, 10 or 20, maybe you can get a little bigger, but you know, at the same time as all this kind of VC money is rushed in, we've moved away from the goal of actually creating a profitable business. And
yeah,
maybe that's been punted or just totally ignored. And
well, eventually it's going to come back and bite them. I mean, you can't just not run a profitable business forever.
Yes and no. I mean, there's, I think like Gary Vaynerchuk has talked about how a lot of what the startup world is today is basically arbitraging to the next fundraising round until an acquisition, which is a really interesting thought experiment, but it has totally kind of obfuscated the need to be profitable. And so,
I mean, it's a Ponzi scheme. Someone's left carrying the bag and they're always hoping it's somebody else. And I guess the ultimate is the public if that company goes public.
Right. Or it's something where, you know, Nordstrom's buys Trunk Club for $300 million, then writes it down by 200 or something like that.
Right.
Right. Of you have, again, these, I don't know if they're unprofitable businesses or they have bad economics or something, but they get acquired and then kind of eventually it comes out. But I, getting back to the original question, I think the way to stay away from Amazon is to build something that is so design driven that they don't want to build it, but also to kind of manage your own expectations of, you know, let me build a profitable business that is a good business. And if I don't try and scale like crazy and kind of get on their turf, I think you can generally be okay.
And to obviously not sell on Amazon.
Yes. I mean, yes and no. I think I still think you can build like a multi-million dollar business on Amazon if it's differentiated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do I want to be selling charging cables or socks or t-shirts or like Easably stuff that you can knock off?
Right.
But the flip side, and actually I haven't mentioned this yet, is the other thing is to use brand as a differentiator, because a lot of the stuff Amazon is doing, be it the private label or stuff like that, is it's very generic. And, you know, Amazon Basics itself is admission that, you know, I need batteries, not a brand. But there are also now these opportunities to use design and other stuff to differentiate and kind of build a brand that even if, you know, faced with a substitute good from Amazon, you will still have people kind of pick yours. And so again, this stuff is very challenging. I'm not at all saying it's easy, but I think there are ways to use all the power that Amazon has given, you know, a physical goods company, all those kind of tools, in a way that will not, you know, lead to impending doom after 2 years and, you know, at a product manager at Amazon spots what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think another one that you just sort of alluded to around counterfeit products that we haven't talked about this story, and I don't know if you wrote about it, but the Birkenstock story.
No, I did not.
Was really fascinating. And I think it may be underreported, and it kind of seems like a bit of a time bomb, I think, for Amazon, because so the story is that Birkenstock pulled out of Amazon because there were so many basically knockoff products that were not only just knockoff products, but products that were essentially shipped to Amazon warehouses masquerading as real products and then being shipped by Amazon as though they were purchased under the Birkenstock product. So you might be going to an Amazon page for something that looks completely official that actually says like this is shipped from Birkenstock, and you end up with a counterfeit product. Hmm. And the way that Amazon has opened up their marketplace and opened up kind of the whole, you know, fulfillment side of their business is leading to a lot of opportunistic kind of essentially fraud on their platform. And I'm curious to see whether they're able to like curb it quickly or not.
Yeah. I mean, I would give them the benefit of the doubt that it just will take time to do this. And that, you know, given how they have PageRank and all these other things that will basically start to, like they can start to basically push all that stuff down the page, if not cut it out eventually, if they get better at it. The other part of this too, and I think this lesson goes outside of, you know, this industry itself, is, you know, platforms are very different and kind of like to have it both ways generally. And so Uber, for example, really likes to be the one that, you know, matches you with the driver and takes all the money, but they don't want to, you know, have them as employees. And they kind of, you know, if something bad happens, they kind of put their hands up and maybe they'll blame it on the driver. I think Airbnb is a similar way, which is they love to facilitate the transaction and take the credit and kind of, you know, be the thing that, you know, takes the trust away from just being hotels. But if you kind of call on that, they kind of go, oh, well, I mean, we're just a platform. Hey, you know, you should talk to that person. And I think Amazon is a similar thing, which is, you know, as that kind of, you know, self-inflicted middleman in a way, you want to take all the credit, but you don't always want to take the responsibility. And so I think this is something we're seeing play out just across all just kind of tech first platforms today about, you know, where are the lines, what is my problem, what is yours, and kind of where do vendors who are turning into commodities in a way, you know, because Amazon is the one that owns those customers, you know, how do they kind of fit into that? So, I mean, I have no clue what the solution is, but it's really interesting and also super frustrating sometimes to be a part of, you know, that process as these platforms figure it out.
So thinking a little bit about 2017, like if you were an entrepreneur starting something new in 2017, what would you do? We've talked about the cost structures. We've talked about the channels of distribution. We've talked about branding and design as an important criteria. I guess it'd be interesting to hear your perspective on what do you think a new brand, let's say the third generation of DNVBs, are going to look like, the ones that will start next year, and maybe what's in store for some of the ones that we know already that are going to be evolving over the coming year.
Sure. So I've not thought about any of this, but here it goes. You know, to bring back what we talked about before, which is personalized CPG, I think it's a really interesting angle. I don't really know how much this has been explored at all, but I think there's something interesting there, which is, you know, using scale and kind of standardization, but delivering you something that is yours in a way. I would kind of put that as one. I think kind of more specifically in fashion itself, we're going to see more wholesale brands pop up, which I think is actually really great and really interesting because you have all these boutiques and department stores that have really captive audiences that people want to tap into. And forever, those have worked as, you know, very viable ways to build a business.
Well, the Garrett Light episode that you did, I listened to that, was great. Kind of getting a picture of how they're building a glasses brand using wholesalers in a modern way. And I think it's really smart, and it's weirdly a bucking of the trend. It's
right.
Like interesting. I like that.
Yeah. It's just like the thing that has always worked in a way. And yeah. And there are 100% are parts that they've modernized and figured out. But I think Bezos has a quote, which is the conventional wisdom is usually right, mm-hmm. which I think is worth thinking about. I'm trying to think what else. Personalized CPG, more wholesale, and I think there are going to be some really interesting, you know, developments or kind of right sizing on the venture and kind of acquisition space. I don't really know what they will be. I would assume people are starting, and by people, I mean mostly investors, are starting to get fed up with just burning hundreds of millions of dollars. And basically, you know, as startup L. Jackson has tweeted when he used to exist, you know, subsidizing basically a remote living facility or basically like subsidizing elder care for like the young.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I would just only expect that investors are going to get a lot more or a lot tougher, and rightfully so, on kind of how that money will get spent and how much you can just kind of pump into marketing before confirming that it actually is going to net something that lasts for a long time.
I don't know. One thing that I'm curious to see is what the acquisition market will look like next year. Will more of these companies get gobbled up by the existing incumbents? Will there be any like mergers or, you know, diversifying of their portfolio? I think in the post that I wrote that we referenced, I talked about Bonobos and their strategy building their women's brand Air. Is there room for more of these companies to develop portfolio strategies or to try and recreate the conglomerates that already exists in some of these industries?
Yeah, the idea of kind of the portfolio or the holding company, I think, is super interesting. The general thinking is you can kind of synergize a lot of the back end and the lessons learned and just kind of churn out more of that. And I think Bonobos has done a good job at that. I have no clue the health of the other brands. I would assume right. Bonobos is still by far the biggest and most successful. But I think, you know, there's stuff like that. There's the company that runs MGME, which has also done something like that, of kind of a holding company launch, I think is what they're called. So I think those are definitely opportunities. To the first question, I think, which was about just kind of the acquisition stuff as well, I would assume that there has always been activity on this. I have a feeling a lot of these companies do not want to sell, because I think not that all of these are kind of the next Snapchat, where you kind of see the trajectory and that they don't really need a Facebook or anything to help them. But I mean, I think maybe, you know, going back to Dollar Shave, that will be a really interesting example of, can a big incumbent scoop something up and kind of preserve it to the point where the people and the founders and the employees still want to work there every day? And I'm sure companies like Everlane and Bonobos have been approached by others as well, but I'm not sure what that would really help them, you know?
You know, I do think looking at an adjacent industry for a second, in 2016, I think we did prove out that it's possible to acquire a company in the tech sector and keep it alive. Like Instagram, I think, was like firing on all cylinders this past year, creating all kinds of new features. Like they put out more new stuff this past year than they had. And you might say that's good or bad, maybe.
Right, or not all of it was theirs, but
sure, setting that aside, I think it's hard to argue that Instagram has remained a very independent and interesting company while under the ownership of Facebook. And I think we can say that now with a little bit of perspective now that they've been there for a few years. And I think that that has happened with a handful of companies like that. We don't have historical perspective on VCBs and or DNVBs, like these brands that we've been talking about, being acquired by incumbents and continuing to thrive. We just, there's no
right
history of that. And I think that probably, you know, if we fast forward 10 years to the future, the ones that will still be around, you know, whoever grabs some of these great fashion startups that are popping up all the time are probably the ones that are still going to be alive. You know, we talked about J.Crew, we talked about Gap, you know, there's many more. The ones that will still be alive in 10 or 15 years or 20 years will probably be the ones who had some smart acquisition strategies.
Yeah, I mean, I think the counter argument, though, is that I don't know what acquiring a DNVB does if you're a struggling incumbent right now. Like,
yeah, that's a good point.
Obviously, there's a balance sheet implication to this, but the fact is, like, I'm trying to think what the analogy is. Like, basically pretend you have like a gunshot wound and then you just like bought another body, but you still have the gunshot wound in a way.
Well, I think, I mean, Unilever is interesting because they were not really in the shaving market, actually,
right,
which was unusual for them. They sort of bought.
Right, it was additive.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you can imagine Procter & Gamble that could have done that move and it would have been basically jumping from one, you know, lily pad to another. It's like
right,
they would have seen maybe kind of the Gillette kind of brand go down and this other one come up, acquire that one, and now you still have a large market share.
Right. Yeah, and so but I think that's a really interesting question is, you know, there you can acquire something to have it on the balance sheet or you can acquire it for some sort of kind of strategic.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I would consider Dollar Shave, as you alluded to, a very strategic thing. And I feel like Ben Thompson might have wrote about this, which is Procter & Gamble actually could not have bought it because it would have been such kind of an FU to Gillette, who they paid, I think, an absurd amount of money for. And so, yeah, I think the M&A side of it will be really interesting, but I don't really see, I mean, how, I mean, you could look at Trunk Club and Nordstrom as, okay, that was an interesting acquisition, but they just wrote it down for, I think, $180 million. And so did it help, you know, drive people into the store or something? Maybe, but I feel like most, again, this is not mine at all, but like most mergers fail, most acquisitions fail. And so I would be wary of kind of any quick solutions there that, you know, if Gap bought Everlane, it would fix something right away because you still have the struggling thing.
Yeah,
that is not changed by the acquisition, especially if they're kept separate, which to Instagram's point is what actually made it, the acquisition itself successful.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't know. Anything else for 2017 that you're guessing?
I'm not like terribly huge on predictions just because, I don't know. I feel like it's this weird thing of like you predict it and then you like check in with it and then it's just this whole thing. But for lack of a better term, I feel like stuff is getting like real finally.
Yeah.
All the kind of chaos and noise about D2C and DNVBs and all this stuff is coming back to earth. And maybe the theme of this whole discussion is just like stuff is getting boring in a way, which is actually really great because I think the second the press moves on from it is actually when you have the people that are starting companies for the right reasons. And basically it's almost like a bell curve, which is early on you have the people that start it when no one's paying attention. In the middle, it's terrible because everyone's paying attention and people are starting maybe for the wrong reasons. And then after that kind of wave has passed, you have the people that are, you know, maybe they've learned from all that and actually you're going to go start it for the right reasons. And so I feel like from a D2C perspective, we're kind of coming down the right side of that curve where it's not kind of the cool thing to do anymore that it used to be because you're not early anymore, but you can do it correctly maybe, or you can do it for the right reasons. And so maybe that is my 2017 prediction, which is it's going to get more boring, but that's really, really good.
Yeah. I think it goes well with your theme of there's not just one right way to do it. And I think that that's very true. And it's a boring, that's a boring thing to say.
Right. And I think the flip side, you know, or the other part of it too, is that I think the internet's really, really challenging in that, you know, on the one hand, you can build these niches out, but it's also really, really hard to do that and really, really hard to scale that. And so in a weird way, I'm actually really happy that I think the expectations are becoming more realistic in a way, and that there's not this default towards, you know, just a D2C brand, just start it and it'll succeed, or, you know, just open a retail store and it'll work. And that maybe in a weird way, we're coming full circle to the fact that building like an old school retail business is really, really hard. And we're just back doing that. And it's really, really hard just in a new kind of modern way on a different sort of platform. Yeah, I don't really know if stuff has gotten easier. I think it's always hard. Building a business is always hard. I think they're just new tools. But, you know, obviously with those new tools, it comes a whole new set of challenges. And so, yeah, I hope it stays really complex and the nuance is really important. But I also enjoy that it's starting to get a little more boring from a kind of press and hype perspective.
Cool. Well, let's end on Loose Threads itself. I think 2016 seemed like a big year for you. A lot of good articles coming out because that's your second year basically doing it, right?
I think it's the second full year, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's say it's phase two of, I guess, the blog itself where I start. I launched a podcast this year and started to do a lot more kind of more holistic and also some longer, more in-depth stuff. But yeah, I'm excited to see where it goes for 2017. The readership has never been bigger, which is super exciting. I'm lucky that right now there's no pressure on it. So it's kind of, I write and do it when I have something to say. I enjoy that. And so I think hopefully we can keep that going and hopefully what I have to say gets a little better and is obviously informed by talking to people like yourself all across the industry. And so, yeah, I'm excited to see where it goes.
So if people want to check it out, loosethreads.xyz.
Yes, your favorite top level domain. And there's a newsletter, which would be awesome if you want to sign up for. It does not abuse your email. It just kind of pings you when there's new stuff. And then there's also a podcast, which is on the same page. And
Twitter.
I'm trying to think. Yeah, there's Twitter, website, podcast, email.
What's your Twitter handle?
At rsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L. And then loosethreads is just at loosethreads.xyz.
Well, your personal Twitter is also fascinating because you're often sharing all the articles that are popping up pretty much every day about what we just talked about.
Yeah, thank you. It's kind of, I feel like I've turned my Twitter into kind of like a personal scrapbook. And so I'll kind of just, everything I read that I like will end up just kind of being tweeted. And for me, it's like nice because I can go back and look for stuff. If I talk to someone, they're like, hey, you should go check out this article. But I guess some people like that too. So yeah. And then there's also just like a bunch of stupid stuff on there about Airbnb being annoying and all that. But yeah, it's generally focused on kind of this triangle, which I've, you know, started to carve out, which is what I call kind of the intersection of fashion, tech, and commerce. But yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. It was great. Hey. Hey, you. Yes, it's Stefan, and I'm breaking the fourth wall of the outro in this episode. If you're a regular, well-made listener, you may have noticed the slight slowdown in episodes, but we're coming back strong. This is our first episode of the new year, and we have so many more on the schedule already, so we're really excited to be back. However, I did notice, it did come to my attention, that some of you have been complaining about the lack of episodes and yet not writing reviews on our iTunes page. That is the number one thing that you can do to help this show get better and grow and get more listeners. So if you have been enjoying our episodes, consider this a passive-aggressive or maybe just plain aggressive admonition to go please share your love for the show on iTunes. See you next time.